Welcome to the Maker Mag podcast, where we interview prolific people on the maker scene and get their insights on maker culture, working, and fundraising. This month's guest is Sahil Lavingia, co-founder of Gumroad, a company that helps creators easily sell and distribute their products. Before we continue, I would like to say that this podcast is made possible by our sponsor, Blockstack, which is working hard on bringing fundamental digital rights to all. To read stories of fellow makers working with Blockstack to build decentralized applications, go to blockstack.org/makermag. That's blockstack.org/makermag. Welcome to the podcast, Sahil.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be a part of this.
So thanks for joining us. Before we discuss your thoughts on indie making and kind of running an independent business, I'd love to start with an overview of your background as an entrepreneur and the brief story behind your starting Gumroad and what got you here.
So I got started in my career pretty young. I think I was 13 or 14 doing web design for clients I found through forums on the internet. And then I started making iPhone apps. Myself, typically, I think when you start designing for clients, it's sort of an inevitability that you're going to have your own ideas for things that you want to make yourself. And so I started learning how to code off these videos I found on iTunes University from Stanford about iOS development. Then I went to college and only lasted there for a semester before I got a job at Pinterest to make Pinterest for iPhone. So I dropped out of USC and moved up to the Bay Area. And I was at Pinterest until I started Gumroad, which is the company that I still run today. Started that company in 2011, raised $1 million seed round, a $7 million Series A, a $2 million bridge after that. So over $10 million in total. And then did a round of layoffs in 2015 when we weren't able to raise a Series B because we weren't growing fast enough for venture investors. And since then, I've built Gumroad into a profitable, growing company, sustainable. We're around 8 to 12 people now, depending on if you count remote, part-time people. And it's going great. We're helping more creators get paid than ever before, and we're doing it with a lean and mean team. And it's really fun, which I think is really important and used to not be a priority for me, but now it is. Now it's sort of the essential priority for me.
Interesting. So you've spoken a lot before, and you mentioned that again there about the fact that you raised venture capital and then you decided to build an independent business. So could you tell me more about how you navigated from raising all this venture capital money to deciding to kind of go against the grain and pursue an independent business and kind of what factors you considered there in your making that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it was almost a necessity to do. You know, it was almost just a thing I had to do. I was sort of forced to do it, which I think made it possible. I don't know if I had sort of the full gamut of options that I would have chosen this specific path, even though I think in hindsight, it turned out to be the best one. So I'm grateful for that. I think there were really three options on the table when we, you know, so to sort of just set the scene a little bit, we talked to investors for, you know, half a year, 9 months, weren't able to raise a Series B. We had $300,000 or $400,000 in the bank, burning, you know, $300,000 a month. So we were pretty close to running out of money. And we could either sell the company, we could either downsize and keep going, or we could shut it down, right? And just say, we gave it a good shot. We spent 3 or 4 years on it, but it wasn't the thing we were all expecting. And I just felt, I think the variable in the equation that made it really tricky was the creators that were using Gumroad and earning their livings off of Gumroad, or even the creators just earning a little bit of money off of Gumroad. We were processing at the time a little over $2 million a month. And so, you know, the decision to just say, we're going to turn that off because, you know, we don't feel like it. I don't feel like it. I think that was just impossible for me to do. And so, you know, I ended up picking the path that would allow Gumroad to continue to operate for creators to continue to get paid out, which was to do a really large round of layoffs. We went from 20 employees down to 5. But it was, you know, what we needed to do to control our own destiny. And that was the most important thing to do. And that's what we did. And you're right. I think it's a path that a lot of people don't take. And I wish more people took it.
So how did you actually go about kind of getting back the ownership stakes that you'd sold to VCs and kind of actually moving from a VC company to your own independently owned business?
At the end of the day, the tricky thing with raising money is that it's not up to you sell it back, to buy it back, right? Like they have rights. And so if they wanted to, if you want it back, you have to convince them that it's the right thing for them to do for them, right? You shouldn't do it sort of maliciously or anything like that. I think in my case, Kleiner started the conversation because they were going through, I think, some internal stuff. And Mike, who was on our board, had left Kleiner Perkins. And it was an opportunity for them to clean up their books, potentially take a tax write-off. And so I think that's why they opted to do it. But they started that conversation. And then I just sort of let the other investors know, hey, this is what's happened. I'm still running Gumroad. This is sort of the state of affairs. If you want to stay involved, you're welcome to. But if you also want to sell or if you want to negotiate or something, I'm open to that as well. And so that's sort of what I did. And you know, we still have venture investors. We still have, I think, a little under $2 million on the cap table. And we're slowly, you know, working to simplify that part of our business. But, you know, it requires a significant amount of capital and conversations. And the good news is that it you know, we don't have board meetings. We don't have a lot of the operational overhead of having investors. So I can kind of operate it as if it were completely independent, which is really great.
How did your goals change when you decided to build Gumroad into an independent business? Like you've spoken before in some of your past writings about your kind of initial goal to build a $1 billion business. At what moment did you say that that wasn't the right path for you? And what other goal changes did you face at the point where you decided to spin off Gumroad into its own kind of independent business?
It's similar to the other thing where it's, you know, it wasn't really a choice. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I just realized, and I think I sort of committed to that anti sort of billionaire, $1 billion company vision with the publication of that Medium post. I don't know how sold I was on it until I hit publish. And I was like, oh, cool. This is the thing people are going to know me for. So I guess I have to stick to this path now. It was a good forcing function, I think, for that. But, you know, it was just, I realized with the layoffs and more so after that, that like just that sort of $1 billion company was just not going to happen. So I could either keep trying and pretending, or I could just say, look, I tried, I gave it a shot. I have this amazing business still that serves this group of people that I really care about. Let me just focus on that instead. And so that's what I've been up to.
What are the advantages of building a sustainable independent business over aiming to build a $1 billion company and raising venture capital? A moment ago, you spoke about board meetings and the kind of change in nature there. What are the other benefits of people who are considering starting up kind of an indie business over starting a VC, a company they want to be backed by VCs in the future?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think if they're thinking about starting an independent business, they should actually be spending more time focused on the disadvantages of doing that, because they're already probably pretty familiar with the advantages. So I think it's worthwhile to spend time focused on what are the disadvantages of not raising money, because there are certainly several of those. There's a reason, right, that so many people do raise venture capital, even though it is a tiny minority of all businesses that get started in the U.S. In terms of the advantages, the big one is you can make decisions on your own, and you can do it in a way that you're not relying on an external party such as investors to decide for you whether your business lives or dies. And that to me is the sort of the fundamental difference between raising venture and sort of going on this growth focused path versus not and trying to, you know, get to a sort of cash flow positive and building a sustainable business. It's a lower reward, but it's also much lower risk to build an independent business. And I think it's also about what your goals are. If you're trying to change the world, if you're trying to dent the universe, if you're trying to employ hundreds or thousands of people long term, yeah, you might want to think about raising venture. But I think if you just want to build a business that solves a problem for a community that you care about on your own terms, and you want to live a pretty nice life and, you know, have time to spend with hobbies or your family or however you want to spend it, and you want to be able to choose who you want to work with, then trying to build an independent business that's profitable and sustainable is the way to go.
Yeah, that's very interesting indeed. And I do agree that perhaps we don't put as much emphasis on the disadvantages of being an indie developer or maker rather than the advantages of pursuing such a path. To change away from kind of building indie businesses, I remember seeing a tweet from you a while back about Gumroad's financials. What are your thoughts on this whole movement of disclosing your business's financials, and how do you feel about actually sharing that information each month?
Yeah, I mean, I think it keeps me accountable. You know, as I mentioned, we used to have board meetings and no longer do. And the board meetings were a great way to sort of stay accountable. Component to that, I want to show people how to run a business and how to run an independent creative business, because I think those are sort of the demographics of people that we want to build for. And so I think there's a lot of sort of selfish motivation there. And then I also think there's, it's just valuable. You know, the question a lot of people ask me is why do you share your numbers on Twitter? And, you know, the question I ask other people is, why don't you, you know? These are both choices, you know, in certain countries and certain industries, it's the default to share all these numbers publicly. You know how much money the last Marvel movie made. And so I think, you know, you can choose, and you should do what you think is best for you and best for your business and best for the community you're serving and best for the world. And so I think figuring out sort of, you know, the pros and cons of each of those categories and really trying to think about what's the right thing to do. And you know, for a lot of businesses, I think that's not sharing the numbers, which is totally fine. But I think for Gumroad, it allows us to build a more rich connection with our audience, with our customer base. It allows me to interface with the world more frequently, which I don't really do normally. I kind of am a little bit of a recluse. Though that's changed a little bit, in part due to the monthly numbers. That was a thing that got me to start tweeting again after kind of years of silence, basically. And then it just feels good. You know, it just feels like the right thing to do.
Does it cause you stress, or do you feel anything? Like, do you feel weird putting those numbers out? And kind of at the start of the month, do you feel any worry about not hitting the previous goal for the month? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we don't have goals for the month. So there's nothing to hit or not to hit. So there's nothing to really stress about. I think that the being profitable certainly helps, because people don't freak out if they see that you're unprofitable and you might be running out of money or something like that. So I'd sort of recommend probably being profitable if you're sort of considering releasing your numbers publicly, if you have clients that rely on you for their own income. I would say I don't feel worried about it, honestly, anymore. Maybe the first time I did. I mean, I definitely did the first time, but pretty quickly it fades. And it's actually kind of nice, because now when I meet with someone in person, or they kind of know how I'm doing, you know, and I don't have to pretend or puff up my chest or do any of those sorts of things. Like, basically most people I hang out with kind of know, oh, okay, cool, this is where Gumroad's at. And so a lot of that, the sort of the pleasantries and the small talk and the all that stuff kind of goes away when literally basically everybody can know how much money I'm making. And so it's kind of freeing to not have to sort of compete or worry about that. It's not really that you know, that part of my life is not that interesting, doesn't really dominate any of the conversations, because it's just out there, everyone knows. It's not, you know, it's not a secret. You don't have to ask me about any of that sort of stuff that you might want to do. If, you know, for good friends, you might say, hey, how's Gumroad doing? Are you growing? You know, where's it at? How many employees do you have, et cetera? They can go on Twitter. I think it makes my in-person conversations a lot more deeper and a lot more nuanced than I was expecting, which has been a really nice positive side effect of it.
So what are your thoughts on the rise of these indie-focused venture firms like Earnest Capital and IndieVC, which focus on them nurturing makers who are looking to build sustainable businesses over unicorns and billion-dollar companies?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting trend. I think you sort of have this sort of binary almost, you know, you either raise a bunch of money and try to, you know, go big or go home and try to build a unicorn, or you sort of bootstrap or self-fund. And I think there's probably the majority of the opportunity is to provide financing for the middle, that huge middle. Most businesses need to raise capital, but they don't need to raise millions and millions of dollars to get to product market fit or to get to profitability or anything like that. And so I think you're going to see tons and tons of these funds pop up that will serve these sorts of needs that basically traditional bank loans are kind of the competition. And I also think you're going to see a lot of people that are maybe employed somewhere, but you know, all they need is a couple hundred grand to go full time on a business. And you know, you can get really far with just one or two engineers, a designer, you know, even just one person. And so I think there's a big opportunity. I think you're going to see outsized returns from a lot of these funds. I think the question is, you know, the way that traditional venture works is you have a Facebook or an Uber in your portfolio, which kind of returns the fund several times over. And that's where all the returns come from, or you know, a large chunk. And so when you get rid of that, you need the other investments need to be so, either the hit rate needs to be so high, and or the returns on those other investments need to be so good that you don't need the Facebook and the Uber, right? Because at the end of the day, they're competing for LP money, right? And so they still have to take the money and return it in a similar way, or a better way if they want to compete. I think that remains to be seen, but I'm super excited. I think and that's the reason I became an LP in earnest. And I spoke at NDVC last month or two, because I really believe that there should be more financing options available for independent makers that want to sort of raise the stakes a little bit, but they don't want to go, you know, switch to this totally unicorn seeking mode.
Yeah, I definitely think there is a need for these independent focused financing models, and it's great to hear your thoughts on that. Switching gears a little bit, in an article that you've published over the past few years, and what you've spoken about on Twitter, over the past few years, it's kind of your experience moving from San Francisco to Provo, Utah, and kind of being in Los Angeles, building and supporting creators in your position at Gumroad. What has been your experience building a startup outside of the Silicon Valley kind of city?
I think it's informed the way that I develop software and the way that I think about building Gumroad, and also the way that I think about just my own life. I think when I left San Francisco and went to Provo, you know, I saw all these people that didn't care about building billion-dollar companies. They thought I was weird for even thinking that was a failure. And so it was really nice to kind of have that new perspective on how other people's priorities can look like, and how maybe the priorities that I had before were slightly mimetic. They were just kind of copied from the people and the industry that I was in. And so, I think it just kind of gave me it was almost like, you know, people do drugs or whatever, and they have this open-minded experience about how they should be spending their time. And I feel like that was like, Provo, Utah was like that for me.
Interesting. How would you say building a company outside of Silicon Valley has kind of influenced the values that company's cultivated, considering there's not this pressure for you to talk about your failed startups and the culture is really different as you discussed there? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you realize how much of the metrics that you're focused on are informed by trying to impress the people within your industry and your friends and the other companies and founders that you hang out with. Things like how many employees you have, how much revenue you're doing, how much money you've raised and who you've raised from. Those are things that basically no one really cares about outside of Silicon Valley. And so living in Provo, you know, where people are like, oh, how many creators, you know, do you help? And how many creators do you serve? And how do you spend your time? And how much do you work on Gumroad? And what do you do for fun? And where are you from? And these, just the questions that people ask are so different. And it just made me prioritize those more. And so I think the value-wise, I think Gumroad is much more focused on creating value and serving creators, serving our existing creator base, instead of always seeking growth, you know, growth is actually not the priority at all anymore. It's just building a really great product for our existing customers. Actually, someone in Utah told me this quote that I love, which is, enough is a decision, not an amount. And I really like that framing. I use it a lot in my day-to-day thinking, where I'm like, I have enough creators. Enough creators use Gumroad every month. I don't need any more. And so I'm just going to work to make their lives better. And if they want to tell their friends to use Gumroad too, that's awesome. But I'm just focused on what I can control, which is to make a really solid product, make it faster, fix bugs, add features that creators want, and the rest will take care of itself.
Interesting. Semi-recently, you posted a tweet that was kind of talking about how people in the future might see Silicon Valley like a college, where you go there for a few years, you'd learn all of the culture, and then you'd move on to another city with kind of cheaper rent, a different culture, and so on. So what are, would you say that it was useful for you to spend those years in San Francisco? And could you talk more about what the inspiration was behind that thought?
Yeah. Oh man, I don't even know if I remember. It struck a nerve that I wasn't expecting. It was an observation, I think. I saw myself do that. You know, I went to San Francisco for 6 years, worked at a startup, started my own company, raised money, hired people, and then left. And I saw a lot of my friends start doing similar things, even the people that had started billion-dollar companies. They were planning on having kids or what have you, and they felt that San Francisco was not the place that they wanted to do that. And so I think it was inspired in part by just seeing this story play out over and over again at a frequency that was much higher than I was expecting. And so it was kind of just an observation on the present and then the future. And I think just the acknowledgement that, you know, maybe San Francisco is not going to fix the housing crisis. You know, it's not going to build tons of housing, and the solution is not to make San Francisco livable for 3 million people, but actually that people come in and leave and make space for new people. And that's kind of how a college is set up. And, you know, people come to a school that for a few years, they learn, they network, they work really hard, and then they leave and they go wherever they want to go to apply those sorts of skills. And so it's not a judgment. I think some people took it as like, this is a good thing, which I never said. I just said, I think this is happening and will happen more, basically. So I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm not making a moral judgment on it. I'm just observing a trend that I see happening. And I think people kind of use it as like a little bit of an object in which to have their own point of view stated. But I never said anything. I don't even really have a public opinion on if that's a good thing or not. I think it's a very complex topic that I just don't know enough about to really have a strong opinion.
So kind of on that same note, what are your thoughts on this whole movement for pioneering remote working? And how do you think that'll change the way which people kind of experience culture and entrepreneurship, because we are no longer based in a specific city, but rather we are online interacting with people of different cultures? So what do you think the benefits are of remote working, and how do you think that influences people's mindset as workers, and where do you think that will go in the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the great things about living in a place like San Francisco, similar to going to school, is you're kind of given a roadmap, you're given a plan, you're allowed to sort of be mimetic, and it works relatively effectively. And so I think figuring out, okay, what does a school provide? What does a college provide? What does a city provide? What does an industry provide? You know, things like networking, things like, people around you that you can sort of copy from, people that you can, you know, build relationships with, the serendipity that can happen at a coffee shop, the density of engineers and designers and executives and PMs and investors. And then also just the fact that everyone passes through San Francisco. So if you live in San Francisco and you're in tech, like basically everybody visits at least once a year, if not more. And so, you know, you can kind of always have a plan to meet somebody. When I moved to Provo, that changed completely. So those things, you know, I think remote work will have to figure out those things. I think it can be great because you're starting with a more representative pool, typically of the customer base that you're going to be building for. You know, unless you're building for just San Francisco startups, like you're unlikely to have a representative pool by just building in San Francisco and hiring people in San Francisco. I think it's a lot cheaper to hire remote. I think that's something that doesn't get talked a lot about because it doesn't sound cool, but you know, at the end of the day, remote work is typically going to be cheaper. You get to hire people from different geographies that are not as expensive as San Francisco and New York. So it means you can hire more people potentially and build faster. To me, the way that I think about remote work is how do you bootstrap your network? It's really hard to do that online because the bar is so low to create a Twitter account and start tweeting and to start engaging with people. And so I think figuring out how you can build your credibility online and start networking and meeting people and build deep relationships with people, not just surface level ones. I think that's really hard to do online today. You know, I was hanging out last night with a Gumroad creator, a musician that I've been a fan of for a long time. And we just chatted for 3 or 4 hours, you know, and you can't do that on the internet. It would be weird.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on this movement toward no-code making and how that's going to change in the future and evolve to increase access to building these sustainable products, and how you think the increase in capital and the increase in makers kind of building no-code products will intersect and create more value for people in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think the no-code movement is great. I think the easier and the more options that folks have, both engineers and non-engineers alike, will benefit from that. And so I'm a huge proponent of tools that make it easier to build and prototype and test. I think coding is still essential if you want to build a business long-term at some point, but I think the farther that you can get without it, the better, right? It makes it more accessible. It makes it cheaper. It makes it faster. And so I think... I'm a huge fan of it, and I think the only concern I have with it is that people will think of it as an excuse not to learn how to code. And I think you can do both. You can learn how to not code, and you can learn how to code at the same time. And it's just a thing that you can do. It's just a weapon in your arsenal if you know how to code a little bit. You know, it teaches you logic and data structures and algorithms and you know it. When you get to a scale or when you get to a certain problem, it's going to be useful to be able to think like that, in my opinion. Just like I would say everyone should learn how to design to some level, because understanding typography and things and, you know, information architecture and things like that are useful things to be able to do.
So to go further on that, do you think that no-code tools will kind of serve as a breaking in point for people who are interested in kind of the notion of building apps, but helping them actually understand the basic logic, and then that would perhaps serve as a funnel for them to go on to actual code?
Totally. Yeah, it massively broadens the top of the funnel. It's sort of the gateway drug, in a sense, to learning how to code. And so I think in that way, yeah, I think actually the no code movement is going to probably create more coders than not.
I think that's a good place to close. Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work at Gumroad?
The best place is my Twitter. So if you just follow me on Twitter, my handle is @SHL. I also tweet from the Gumroad account if you want to follow that, which is @Gumroad. And then our blog is a great place. You can sign up for our email newsletter at gumroad.com/gumroad for email updates on all the things that we're building. So those are the top three places to go in order.
All right. Thanks for joining us in the Maker Mag podcast, Sahil.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you want to listen to previous episodes of the Maker Mag podcast, you can do so at makermag.com/podcast. That is makermag.com/podcast.